Calling all dancers, let's put on her dancing shoes. Google one, the barbecue, it's good for you. Live it up.
On the line is the MP for Niagara Center and the Parliamentary Assistant or Parliamentary Secretary to the to Indigenous Services, Vance Badaway. Vance, welcome to the show.
That's great to be here. How are you guys all doing?
Oh, you know, well, very much like you today. We are rather busy jumping from one celebration to another celebration.
Absolutely.
Interview to interview. Now, before we get into the hard-hitting, the serious questions, Vance, we've had this theme of what music from your generation, what speaks to you? Let our listeners know. If you can play one song, what song is that going to be, Vance?
Oh, geez. Well, I'm a Stevie Ray Vaughan. I'm a Stevie Ray Vaughan fan, so lots of songs there. But you know, it's one song. It'd be hard to pick. It's just a whole slew of different songs.
I get all misty when I hear "Life by the Drop." I don't know what it is. Like it just like chokes me up. I love me some Stevie Ray Vaughan. So
and you know what song? And I just heard it recently, and it's Leanna's favorite song, and it always gets to me. Is "Hallelujah."
Oh
that
yeah,
song
yeah,
just yeah. Always gets to me.
Yeah, that's deep. That's deep. Now, is it the Cohen version or which version of "Hallelujah" do you rock out to?
It's funny you mention that because all of them, you know, and every time you hear a new person sing it, it just gets better and better and better. And as you said, being deep, it's you know the emotion that comes out of that song. I heard a young lady a couple weeks ago, and it was just phenomenal. It just comes straight from the heart.
I think I know the theme of your backyard parties now. So, but I this all started with hip hop though. Do you have any generational hip hop in your playlist there?
Oh, I do. You know what? I have everything in my playlist. Depends what kind of mood I'm in. It's funny because when I drive to Ottawa, I turn the music on. It's quite loud. All the way up to Ottawa, I listen to everything from country to rock to heavy rock to light rock. Classic rock, hip hop, everything. I just love music.
Now are you windows up, screaming at the top of your lungs type of driver, or hair down, blowing in the wind?
Just once in a while I get the vocal cords going, but yeah, thank God there's nobody around because it's not very good.
Nothing gives me more joy than when you look over at the car next to you and the person is just rocking out to something.
Oh yeah,
it just makes me so happy.
Or when you're doing it, they're looking at you thinking, "Who's this crazy guy beside me?"
I've used my pen as a drumstick like so many times in the car, tapping away. Something else that brings me joy is seeing you at community events. I think it was really touching what happened in Niagara Falls today. You were at Phyllis Webstad Beyond the Orange Shirt story. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau came to Niagara Falls this morning, the sunrise ceremony, stayed for several hours, listened to the Survivor Circle. I don't even think you got in on the Survivor Circle. That was just for Justin Trudeau and the survivors and a select few leaders in our community. Can you reflect on this morning's events a little bit?
Well, you know, in one word, spectacular. It was just so touching to get there early in the morning and take part in the sunrise ceremony with all the survivors there and Phyllis and so many others, the Prime Minister coming out. And then, of course, as you said, the Prime Minister going inside the power plant and having a great discussion with some of the survivors. Him alone and about 10 to 15 of them. It was very good. And then after that, following that, having you folks host what happened on stage, there was no one highlight. They were all a highlight. Everyone that spoke, all the folks that played along, the music and the entertainment, as well as the Prime Minister's words, were just so touching. He just came off so genuine, as he always does. And it was really heartfelt. And then, of course, after that, after the formal ceremony and all the activities that were happening, just speaking with people, Phyllis and others that were there and listening to some stories, reflections, it was just truly, truly a good day in the Falls. And it really makes us all here in Niagara proud when we can all get together and really ensure that we understand one thing, and that's the respect. And beyond that, that dreams are for everyone. And you know, we all have hope moving forward with truth reconciliation, but with hope comes hard work, and with that, you know, we're all working hard together as a nation-to-nation relationship, and that's very important that that relationship gets stronger as we work together and ensure that the future generations not only learn about what was our past, but equally as important is where we are today and where we can be by working together well into the future.
Now, you may be aware, and I think some of the listeners and people who've been participating in the past week's events, that Phyllis Webstad has been here all week in the Niagara region and speaking at various conferences and forums and such. And earlier on the week, there was a Métis gentleman by the name of Mitch Case who brought up some concerns about the status of the Métis Nation within the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And for the listeners who aren't really familiar, like the Truth and Reconciliation Commission itself was brought on because of the Indian residential school settlement. And while we don't say the term Indian very much anymore, like that word has a very specific meaning when we're talking about this. My question, a long way of getting to my question, is Vance, MP Badaway, you are Métis. So how do you reconcile being Métis and seeing some of, I guess, the gaps? I'm not sure if that's even fair to say, but some of the gaps that exist when it comes to the Métis' participation in residential schools?
Well, you know, let's face it, when we look across the country and we look at the challenges that we're faced with, especially as it relates to First Nations, Métis and Inuit, we're all in it together. And, you know, when we do recognize gaps, we deal with it. And we ensure that, as I said from the start, you know, dreams are for everyone. And while we move forward, it's critical. And in my travels across the country, especially in the last 3 or 4 months, working with First Nations, working with Métis, and working with Inuit, we recognize these gaps, and it's right across the board. There's no doubt. And my job is to take it back and speak with the Minister, Mr. Haidu, Mr. Miller, about it, Prime Minister, as well as caucus and cabinet. And we deal with it, and we ensure that we're going to plug these gaps up and make sure that while we're moving forward, it's all inclusive. And that's very important, and I think that was even recognized today. During the event in Niagara Falls, is that, you know, there's still pain and there's still a hill to climb, but the critical part about it is that we're climbing it together, and we're working together shoulder to shoulder, and that's, you know, we many times as we travel in our lives, we understand what the what is, but what's equally as important is the how. So the how is that, you know, with that hope. As we're all prepared to roll up our sleeves and get into the hard work. And when we recognize those gaps, when we recognize those challenges, we simply deal with it. But the important part is the how we're going to deal with it. And the how is that we're going to deal with it together. And I think, you know, with a lot of the work that we've done, especially in the last 7 years, you know, we're getting there, but there's still a heck of a lot more work to be done. And we're prepared to do that. And when I say we, I mean all of us, all Canadians. And when you look at today being, you know, the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation, that's one of the messages, and the Prime Minister touched on it today as well, is that, yes, it's about our Indigenous peoples, but it's also about all Canadians, because there's an education component added to it, to learn more about what was, but equally as important is what is and what can be. And with that hope and hard work and moving forward together, and that hill that we have to climb, we're going to get there, and I think, you know, it's all worth it. It's all relative, and again, going to your question, when we recognize those gaps, when we recognize those challenges, whether it be with the First Nations, the Métis, or the Inuit, we just simply deal with it.
Now, a lot of the critics, or a lot of the people who are critical of the Liberal government and our Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, would say that he's the first Prime Minister in history who's kind of had this roadmap to reconciliation, and that roadmap being the calls to action from the TRC themselves. And part of that criticism would then be that only 10 of the 94 recommendations, 10 or so of the 94 recommendations have been completed within that 7-year time frame since Prime Minister Trudeau took the office. Does the rate of change come into effect on this? Like, I think to Walkerton and how fast we rallied around Walkerton and cleaned up those drinking waters. But still, boil water advisories are still play a huge role in a lot of our Indigenous communities. What would you have to say to that?
We'll get the answer to Sean's question from Member of Parliament Vance Badaway after this short break. Sean and I spoke with Member of Parliament, Vance Badaway, also the Parliamentary Assistant to Indigenous Services Canada. Here's the rest of our interview with Vance.
There's no doubt that there's a contrast between this government and the government that came before, the Liberals. One of the things that the Conservative government did was they eliminated the evergreen core funding for friendship centers, and they put in a year-by-year renewal for the annual funding, the Urban Partnership for Indigenous Peoples. I've noticed that the evergreen funding for the friendship centers does not look to be on track to be restored. But when you and Minister Haidu are talking about friendship centers, what kind of conversations are you having?
Well, you know, what I am passing on to Minister Haidu is exactly what I'm hearing on, you know, from the stakeholders, those that have the rubber on the pavement. You know, an example is Jennifer Dockstetter in the Fort Erie Native Friendship Center, and her and I have had, and we even as late as today, discussions about that very issue. And you know, when you look at the services that they're providing, not only to our Indigenous community, but also to the broader community in Fort Erie, it's absolutely spectacular what they're doing over there and what Jennifer's doing over there with her team. And you're right. You know, there has to be a more sustainable funding envelope available for our friendship centers, and also urban Indigenous as well as on reserve. So you know, those are the things that we're working on, and that's what we're communicating from what I'm hearing and learning from the partners that are, again, have the rubber on the pavement. That message is being relayed loud and clear to both Minister Haidu and well received, by the way. It's just a matter of the minister being successful in bringing these issues to cabinet and having cabinet to react accordingly.
I do have to commend, and I'll disclose my conflict here. I actually get paid by the federal government in my day job as the executive director of the Niagara Regional Native Center. So I am hoping that core funding does get stabilized and renewed for longer period of time. But I am curious, you do travel, you go to other areas, and so it's not just Niagara that has the Fort Erie Native Friendship Center, the Niagara Regional Native Center. What are you hearing from other friendship centers about the potential for more federal funding?
Well, the same. But you know, Carl, you have to understand, you know, it's there's a lot of needs out there. You know, when you mentioned the Métis earlier, and you mentioned, you know, First Nations, and you went across the entire country, you know, there's a huge need out there. Like, I was in God's Lake in northern Manitoba a few weeks ago. I was in Lac La Ronge a few weeks before that, in Saskatchewan. I was in Edmonton, and I just had a meeting with Chief Hawaii and Barrier Lake in Quebec just the other day. And the needs are great. You know, when you look at education and healthcare, when you look at housing, you look at mental health services, you look at water, wastewater, you look at recreation centers and health and well-being centers and things of that nature. And then on top of that, when you get into the urban areas, how do we reconcile as well as add equality to our urban Indigenous community? And then, of course, a lot of that, and especially in urban areas, those services are provided by the friendship centers. So it's all somewhat one and the same, but at the same time, there's a lot there to do. So when we're presenting to cabinet, you know, the one thing that we have to recognize, and the one thing cabinet has to understand, and they do, by the way, is the fact that is what the priorities are. And the tack that I've been taking, Carl, is when I go in and talk to the chief and the bank councils on reserve, and talk to people like Jennifer at the friendship centers and other organizations. One of the things that I'm trying to do is establish a list of priorities, and it's no different than any community establishing a corporate strategic plan. Identifying those priorities, and once you identify those priorities, attaching action plans to them, and then begin to work together to execute those action plans. And that's exactly that's the tack that we're trying to take. And so whether it's reserve, on reserve, whether it's with friendship centers and with Indigenous folks in urban areas, those are the lists and those are the needs and the wants that we pass on to cabinet. From there, obviously, we all know that there's only so much money to go around for the whole of government. But it is a whole government approach. And when you look at, for example, Minister Haidu's file and Minister Miller's file when it comes to Indigenous and Crown relations for Indigenous peoples, and then, of course, you look at everything else, infrastructure and finance and transport and communities, and the list goes on. One of the things I'm also trying to do is not sort of contain it within one file, but utilize the resources that we have in all the files from all the different departments. And those are some of the things that we're looking at right now. I'll give you an example. When you look at emergency preparedness, you look at BC with the wildfires, it impacts Indigenous communities heavily. you know, we're working with them to make sure that they have the resources available to deal with those unfortunate situations. So it's not just Indigenous Services, my department and Patty's department, and it's not just Crown Relations, which is Mark's department and Jaime's department, but it's also working with Minister LeBlanc in infrastructure. It's also working with Minister Blair in emergency preparedness. It's also working with Christian Freeland in finance, Deputy Minister and Deputy Prime Minister. So it's a whole government approach. And the bottom line, Carl, is that this government is prepared to take it on, and we have been. But it's a big file. And with that said, and the priorities being established and the action plans being attached to those priorities, we are picking away at it. Only so much money to go around, yes, but we're being very strategic. And that strategy comes from you, comes from the Indigenous community. So we're listening, we're learning, and we're doing the best we can to react accordingly to bring it up to par to where the expectations are when we're having these discussions with our Indigenous partners.
One of the issues that always arise when talking about funding to First Nations communities or Indigenous communities is the assumption that we solely reside in reserves. And respectfully, I like just a friendly reminder that the largest portion of Indigenous people live in urban environments, which speaks to the crucial importance of friendship centers. I think it's estimated that 70%+ of our Indigenous population of the 4.9 million Canadians live in that urban environment. And I completely understand when you're saying that we only have so many pieces of pie to go around. I think it's friendly. I don't know. I think it just may be time to reconsider who's getting some of the pie. Because, I mean, in reality, we live in urban environments, right? Like my community of Curve Lake, it consists of 5,000 members, but there's only about 800 people who live on reserve.
Absolutely. And you're absolutely right. And it goes back to my earlier comments. It's a big file. And when we look at Indigenous people on reserve and we look at the needs they have, and by the way, you know, when you get up to the Northwest Territories and northern parts of the country, it's dire. You know, but then again, when you have your population in your urban areas, it's the same thing. And a lot of the issues are the same as well. It's just a matter of, again, making those or hearing and learning what those priorities are. And of course, bringing them to cabinet and having them recognize what they are, and hopefully the funding that both ministers ask for is provided, and we can get a lot more apportioned out to the different Indigenous peoples, whether they be on reserve or in the urban areas. And it goes to your point earlier too, Carl, with respect to the Friendship Centers, and all the credit to them, because they do somewhat work on a shoestring budget. And, you know, in talking to Jennifer and seeing the services that she's providing and other friendship centers across the country are providing, you're absolutely right. You know, there's a need there. It's just a matter of presenting that need and again, getting those expectations met based on what we're hearing from the Indigenous peoples, whether they be on or off reserve.
Thank you so much for your time. It was a genuine delight seeing you this morning.
Yes, you as well. And hopefully we'll see you tomorrow.
Yeah, absolutely. You're coming to the Niagara Regional Native Center, Powell. Is that confirmed?
I will be there. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
I will come up to you and make sure that I greet you with all of the best St. Catharines love that we have. Thank you so much for your time.
You take care.
Vance Badaway, the member for Niagara Center and the Parliamentary Secretary to Indigenous Services Canada. This is the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation Day weekend. Sean and I aren't with you in person because we are at the Niagara Regional Native Center powwow right now. I'm glad you're enjoying this episode of One Dish, One Mic. Thanks for checking out our show. We absolutely adore you. We can't wait to be back live in studio with you. We're going to have a special Thanksgiving episode. I have no idea what we'll be cooking up, but we'll see you live in person next weekend. Sean Vanderclis spoke with Saul Mamakwa, who took some time out of his day on the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation to speak with Sean. Saul Mamakwa is back in Sioux Lookout, back in his own territory. Saul Mamakwa is the member of Provincial Parliament for Kewetinuk, a predominantly Indigenous riding, and of course Saul Mamakwa has challenged a lot of the conventions of provincial parliament, whether it's pledging allegiance to originally the Queen and now the King, standing for God Save the Queen, now King, and generally raising awareness about issues that affect Indigenous people. Saul Mamakwa has been very generous with his time
to come on One Dish, One Mic, and to make sure that he's giving lots of space to Sean and I as Indigenous broadcasters to tell stories from a different perspective. We're grateful for Saul for making this time for us. And without further ado, here's Sean and Saul having a bit of a chat.
Saul, welcome to the show.
Hey, Sean. Good to be here. Bonjour.
Bonjour. So today is the second annual National Day for Truth and Reconciliation. If you had to grade the government on what has been happening over these past couple of years, what grade would you give them?
It would not be a passing grade. I say that because, I mean, like, certainly, like, I think having a National Day for Truth and Reconciliation is something that's a small step. And I think, I know it is a time to reflect deeply on why this day brings us together. And I think it's really important that we must acknowledge, the history together. Our history together, you know, it's since the contact has not always been that great. And I think, when we talk, I talk about the, not a passing grade, because when you actually look at the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's, the 9-4 calls to action, we have to have that political will to be able to invest in actioning those calls to action. And not only that, resourcing them, may put some resources and investing in those, and it doesn't happen. And I think, certainly, again, I think, having a, the Pope visit, this past summer, is okay. And I see, people reconciling, as an act of performance. And but we need to be able to move beyond that, right? And I think so I think there's there are little steps that we are taking, but we need to be able to move forward together and as a collective, that especially this day, right? Like, I mean, September 30th is also, to reflect on the words, every child matters. And I think it's an opportunity that, to plant those seeds of understanding, the seeds of knowledge, the seeds of hope for everyone. And I think especially all the children that, especially for the children today, because they hold the future, in their hands, and it's in their courageous hearts. And, today no child will be forgotten.
Now, I've spent some time up north, and your riding, Kuwaitnung, is located in northern Ontario. And we both know the statistics that exist, that children are apprehended at a significantly higher rate than other children or other Canadians, if you will. Would you say that is what we're talking about when we say every child matters?
I think that is exactly what it means, because I think when we talk about, Indian residential schools and intergenerational impacts, and I go to visit jails, I go, see the child welfare agencies, and you see the overrepresentation of Indigenous people in these facilities and these systems. And that's how oppression and colonialism works, and that the intergenerational trauma that exists, and also not only that, access to clean drinking water, and like even today, I have 14 long-term boil water advisories, and a few months ago, I was up in the First Nation, and there was this child that I, you know, 2-year-old boy that, you know, I saw pictures of him, you know, with skin conditions, you know, scabs, and it was all over her, his body, because, you know, they kept bathing him in the community water, and it wasn't helping. It was making it worse, and I had to get medevaced out. And then, you know, and then the mother started investing in bottled water, and then it soon cleared up. And I think those are the ones that we have to remember. Those are the ones that are continue to face the impacts of colonialism, oppression, and but not only that, like we have to it's the survivors too, you know, the families of survivors, like this intergenerational trauma, intergenerational effects of Indian residential schools goes down, and you see these colonial policies, practices that continue to happen. And those are the ones that we have to remember also, is, you know, the ones that are in care. And because what happens is it has, we continue to have these unnecessary suffering, needless deaths. But Shauna, there's always hope. There's always hope in the work and what we do, because I know I always talk to non-Indigenous schools, and you know, they ask these questions. You know, I think the youngest I ever did a talk was grade 3 and 4 students somewhere in Southern Ontario, and they had these very tough questions for me, and that they were asking me these tough questions, and they wanted to know, learn more, and that's where it gives me hope. You know, is in the youth, the children, and the change that is coming.
That's the point that I want to pause on for a second. We have more of the interview with Saul Mamakwa and Sean Vanderklis, but if nothing else, if you get nothing from Truth and Reconciliation Day, understand that teaching our children to do better, to try to undo this legacy, is so crucial. So I'm ever grateful to Sean, of course, for talking to Saul Mamakwa, but Saul for carving time out on this busy Truth and Reconciliation Day weekend. It's so important that we get these messages out in a good way. Saul's not even from this riding, but he's always very willing to come and to talk to us. So it's really our pleasure to be able to provide some of the airtime that we have for an Indigenous member of provincial parliament. We're going to pause for a second. We will be back with more on this weekend, celebrating the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation. Sean Vanderklis is continuing his interview with Saul Mamakwa, the member from Kiwetinuk, the member of provincial parliament, and they really get into some pretty interesting stuff here. Sean asks about the difference between provincial and federal services, and then asks that million-dollar question. Once someone has heard about the plight of Indigenous peoples, where can people start to help? Saul Mamakwa lays it out in a nice, clear fashion for you. Coming up right now, Saul Mamakwa and Sean Vanderklis.
Now, we often put the fault on the Canadian federal government. We put the fault on churches, the Catholic Church, and all the other churches that seem to exist. But what role does a provincial government play? A lot of times, Indigenous people, we're told that we're the responsibility of the federal government. But does the provincial government have a role in this?
Certainly, provincial has a responsibility as well. Like, you know, when we say, they always talk about this province, how great this province is, but it's only, you know, like when you have, like 14 long-term boil advisories, it's a different Ontario. And they use jurisdictions to be complacent. They use jurisdiction not to do anything. And if that happened in, you know, in Toronto or in Niagara Falls or Ottawa with, over 27 years of long-term boil advisory, that would not be allowed, because we're First Nations, because we're on reserve. We are treated differently, and they use the Indian Act as an excuse not to do anything. And so I think that they do have a responsibility. You cannot just go after, you know, the resources that are up in Northern Ontario, whether it's a forestry, whether it's the minerals that we have. And, you know, it's we have to come together as, you know, approach things with understanding rather than just, you know, access our resources. And we have to come together, because at the end of the day, I always think about, you know, we want better communities, we want better a better Ontario, a better Canada, a better society. And I think sometimes wherever advice that they have, it's not the best sometimes. And they do these performative acts of reconciliation, and they need to put those in action.
And one of the questions that is always posed to Indigenous people by not Indigenous people is, what can we do? People on a local level, people on a personal basis, what could they do? Do you have any advice for our listeners who may want to do something but just don't know what it is to do?
I think one of the things I always say is obviously to read the 94 calls to actions from the TRC. Attend events, like even today, to wear orange, you know, like stand with us. And, you know, like even wearing orange makes a big difference. You become an ally. And I think, you know, I think one of the most important things as well is write to your MP, or write to your provincial member, MPP, and, you know, start talking about how we can change, putting the Indigenous history, the real history of Canada, the real history of Ontario, the way Indigenous people were treated within the curriculum itself. And I think that's really important. And those are some very, you know, some of the, you know, people that can change the trajectory of the thinking of the people in Ontario. And I always say this, Sean, you know, like if I can change engage or, you know, to be aware, like I would have done my job as one person, and that even from this interview, and that's always my goal in talking to people. So I always try and do that. But yeah, it's, there's so many things, but those are some things that you can do.
Well, Phil, thank you so much for your time today. We wish you nothing but the best. And I mean, good luck with getting through all the activities that you have planned for today.
Yeah. Thank you for that, Sean.
Be good. Perfect. Thank you so much, my friend.
Okay, no problem.
Have a good one. Good luck.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
Take care.
That was Sean Vanderklis and Saul Mamakwa talking about two pretty important questions. It's really good to understand the difference between the services offered to Indigenous peoples. And so having a member of provincial parliament that is responsible for a riding that consists primarily of Indigenous people, I think really provides a good overview of the different services. Of course, healthcare, education, those are services that are primarily administered by the provincial government. And then when it comes to the treaty responsibility of the federal government is responsible for all Indigenous people. But then when you have Indigenous peoples in northern communities like the Kiwetinuk riding, that's where you come into this conflict. There just isn't the hospital infrastructure, the transportation infrastructure, even the educational infrastructure that we have here in southern Ontario. I mean, it's abundant, really, when you think about the level of service that we have. I mean, Sean's from Curve Lake, and Curve Lake is definitely a little more remote. I'm from Oneida, so London listeners can appreciate how close to the city we are. But I mean, even in southern Ontario, urban Indigenous peoples can still suffer from a lack of service, from not having the same access to schools, to hospitals, again, to transportation. I mean, I remember growing up as a kid, and you would know, even in southern Ontario, you would know that you were on a reservation as soon as you hit the gravel roads. There wouldn't be money for paving the roads, and that's largely
because if you're listening to this radio show right now and you're not on a reservation and you're in Southern Ontario, it's because some combination of the municipal and provincial taxing system provides you with that basic service. You know, you're able to hop on a bus if you're in London, Windsor, the Niagara areas, even amalgamating our transit system here, Hamilton, of course. So Ottawa, Halifax, all the other places that listen. So these are provincial services that, like, don't get me wrong, there's a need for upgrades, but when it comes to administering these services in First Nations communities, there's going to be a gap there, because the treaties indicate that First Nations peoples are supposed to be partners in the relative wealth of Canada, but without having the same taxation base, without having the same concentration of people, like it's already complicated enough for Ontario to provide services to Northern Ontario in non-Indigenous communities. Nonetheless, on reservations, and we're talking about communities of hundreds of people that are separated in some cases by hundreds of kilometers. And even if you had the same wealthy tax base that, again, relatively speaking, that we have here in Southern Ontario, it would be really, really tricky to administer. So you take that, and then you take honestly, sometimes gaps in quality of provincial services in the first place, you compound them with the complications of administering service through a sometimes unnecessarily complicated Indigenous services administration offices, and you put them in northern and remote communities, and you've just got problems that compound. But here's the thing: that's not the fault of Indigenous peoples. We have treaty agreements. We agreed to a number of treaties, and it just doesn't make sense that the federal government tends to shirk its responsibilities. And just because the problem is complex doesn't mean that the government doesn't have a responsibility. And frankly, the problem seems expensive. But when you think of the relatively small population of Indigenous peoples, I mean, Salmamaqua's riding is the smallest riding in all of Ontario. So relatively speaking, sure, it seems like a lot of money, but Canada gets quite the benefit, and has gotten quite the benefit for over the past 150 years. So it just seems logical to help out with these services. So again, talking to Saul helps shine a light on that. And of course, Saul is offering the advice on where people can go to learn more, and it's good advice. Check out the 94 calls to action. There is a Truth and Reconciliation Commission that happened that really should make it easy for you. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back. Patty Kroek. I love saying that. I love saying author Patty Kroek. Patty, are you used to that yet?
I love hearing it.
It's not nothing.
No, and it's still very surreal. Like, it's still very surreal. But yeah, I love hearing it. I love seeing people taking pictures of the book. The pre-orders are starting to land in people's hands. It's actually on the bookshelves at another store in Toronto. So yeah, so that's pretty fun.
If you're listening in Toronto, which you can hear One Dish, One Mic in Toronto, Another Story has hard copies of Becoming Kin. Go and grab a copy. Let's sell out every copy of Becoming Kin. I've read this book. You asked me to pre-read it. I did pre-read it. I just never gave you the feedback because I'm a terrible procrastinator. But I enjoyed it. Like, I have to tell you, I sat down and I read 75% of the book in one setting, and then the rest of the book, like, the next moment that I had, I re-read it. When you did the author reading, this probably isn't very exciting for the listener to listen to, except that it is the type of book you can't put down. It's chock full of ideas. It's for everyone. When you were writing the book, who are you visualizing as the reader of this book, Patty?
Well, I was thinking about the communities that claim me, right? Because Indigenous people always say, like, who claims you? Who claims you? It's not just about who you claim, but it's about who claims you. So I was thinking about the communities that claim me. And then, so first off, that would, you know, that's my mom's, you know, my mom's community, you know, migrants, refugees. That's my maternal side of the family, which of course would also include the Black diaspora, people who came as slaves. So how do they find belonging in this place? Because going home is not, you know, is not what we're talking about when we talk about land back. You know, and that was never, that was never the agreement that was, you know, the relationship that was on offer. So how do they find belonging in this place in a way that doesn't displace Indigenous peoples? And then it's also, you know, for the settlers and people who are descended from settlers. Like, how do they redefine themselves? You know, how do they think differently about their relationship in this place rather than, you know, kind of inevitable conquest and displacement? How can they find belonging here? And then, of course, it's for Indigenous peoples, too. Not because I think I have anything to teach Indigenous people. I didn't grow up in my community, even though it turned out to be not that far from me. So people who grew up in their communities obviously have more to teach me. But it's also to help maybe give them language to explain to settler relatives or, you know, people in the workplace why these things continue to have ongoing impact, why policies should be looked at and changed, why we should question our assumptions. Because I know I have really benefited from Indigenous media in that way, in getting really good language to talk about these things.
No, it's such a unique topic to come to. How, explain that process, Patty, for our listeners. How did you get to writing about this topic here? Is it the time that we're in where people always coming to Indigenous people and wanting to know? How did you get to that?
Well, I think we really are in a moment right now. And these moments come historically, and if we blow it, there will be another, you know, it'll come again. But I think we really are in a moment where people are listening and kind of questioning the histories they were told, which is why I talk about unforgetting the past, because these histories that are kind of new information, somebody's always known them. Black and Indigenous peoples have been writing and talking about these things for as long as the Europeans have been here. So it's not like we didn't know these things. There's been this kind of collective forgetting in favor of, you know, kind of the Canada the Good narrative that we're so familiar with. So it's about looking back at our history and then what can we build differently? Well, how would our relationships have looked different if we had, you know, kind of approached this relationship differently? And if we want it to be different, what can we do now? What can we do now so that 100 years from now, we're still not being shocked and appalled by the colonial things that are happening today? So what can we do differently? And becoming kin, to be honest, that idea, I was interested, very interested in the church at that time. That was what was going on in my head, was how the church had talked about home and belonging while displacing Indigenous people physically and spiritually. So how can the church do better? It was really kind of where my thinking was initially. And then the editor from Broadleaf, who kind of, you know, discovered me in the malt shop, because I didn't set out to write a book, she approached me. After reading my Twitter feed, I might mention. So she approached me after a article was published in Sojourners Magazine and asked if I had ever thought of writing a book, and was talking about Indigenous ideas of kinship saving us all. And I thought, well, it's not our responsibility to save you. You've got your own messes to clean up, and we also have our communities to rebuild. But how can we become kin? How can other ways of thinking about our relationship bring us to a better place? That was really interesting to me. And so that's how that whole thing happened. Because I didn't set out to write a book. The book kind of came to me, and then I was like, okay, I've been yelling on Twitter for a while now that somebody needs to do this, so I guess that's me.
Well, that's what I think is really interesting, and that's something I want to pick up on. So you say in the book, how can we find a way to live in the knowledge that we are all related? How can we become better kin? But you answer it. And that, so I don't want to spoil the book for people, but how many times have you and I done a presentation, or Sean, you can relate to this too, and at the end of the presentation, somebody walks up to us and goes, yeah, but how do I turn these ideas into action? You get into that a lot in the book, don't you?
Yeah, well, and again, I cannot say enough nice things about my editor. She was wonderful. You know, so she came up with this idea of having kind of a task, a call to action. And that's what the TRC did. That's what the report into missing and murdered Indigenous women did. That's what the inquests always, you know, that's what inquests do, is they come up with calls to action, with things that people can do. And so she suggested putting those at the end of each chapter. And so each chapter does have a very specific task okay, now that you know this, here is something you can do. And it, you know, it starts very basically by noticing, just paying attention to us. Where are we in your life? And then it gets progressively, you know, each chapter kind of builds on, you know, until at the end, you're fairly well equipped to make some change in your community, to make some change maybe in your church or in your family or, you know, because we're all organized somewhere, right? Whether it's a soccer club or a workplace, or a friendship center, we're all organized somewhere. So how can we then think in terms of that place and what can we do differently in that set of relationships that pushes Canada or our church or our community to what we think we are, to what we could be?
Now, we've been previewing your attendance on this show starting at 11 o'clock all morning today, as well as talking about Phyllis Webstack coming down to the Niagara region, putting on the performance there. And that has led to conversations about churches in general. And given that this is News Talk 610 CKTB, and we do encourage audience engagements, we've just received a text saying, you never look at all the good the Catholic Church did. And I find that very fitting, given what you're attempting to do with your book. So what would you say to this person, Patty, who said that? You never look at all the good the Catholic Church did. How would you respond in relationship to your book?
Good for who? That's my question. All the good they did, for who? And at what price? You know, who benefited from all of this good? And really, I would push back hard on that and say, 95% of what people talk about is all of the good that the Catholic, the soup kitchens and the homeless shelters and all of those other things. I think, you know, the good of what churches do dominates conversation. And so when we push back on that and say, actually, there shouldn't be graves in schoolyards, actually, pushing us aside and hoarding all of this wealth so that the church can have land, actually not paying your court-ordered reparations, those things are not good, then people get mad. And they say, you're just saying they're terrible. We need to look at our stuff honestly. And, because we can't make things better if we don't admit what went wrong. And I would really think that a church, whether we're talking Protestant or Catholic, whose entire deal is confession and repentance, would understand that. We are at the confession stage. And if they just want to rush straight ahead to repentance, and it's like, no, that's not even how it works within your theology. You got to lay out the things you did wrong. And until you do that, and unless you're willing to look at the different layers of where things went wrong, whether or not your intentions were good, and I'd argue on that one too, we can't move forward to repentance, and neither can you. So their entire theology is based on confession and repentance. So I don't, so this pushback on the confession part is really interesting. I do. So we're launching the book. Book launch is on the 27th, and we're hosting it at Silver Spire Church in St. Catharines. It will be a conversation, so basically an episode of Medicine for the Resistance, because it'll be a conversation with myself, Carrie Goring, and Dr. Robin Bourgeois from Brock University. And we actually chose Silver Spire because a large part of the book is, I'd want to say a large part of it, it's woven into the book, the kind of the unexamined Christian history in these countries. Because even if people don't think of themselves as Christian anymore, Canada and the U.S. are still very Christian countries when you look at whose stat holidays are involved. Even Trump posed in front of a church, right? Like that's kind of how embedded this thinking is in our, in these countries. So we wanted to have that conversation about this unexamined Christian history. And then that's something that this church in particular is working hard at doing. Conversations I've had with Karen, one of the ministers there. And so we decided to kind of take that conversation right to the belly of the beast, so to speak, and do it there as a way of, kind of she's going to be moderating the conversation. Because when we make it all so spiritual about, we brought you Jesus and we brought you the truth, it's a really neat way of evading the consequences of missionizing, because residential schools, churches on reserves, you know, all of those things have had like serious material consequences for Indigenous people. And that's not really examined very well. And so that's what this conversation wants to do as a way of launching the book out into the world. Books will be available there. You know, so if people want to, you know, wait, come on Tuesday and pick a copy up there, they will be there too.
I got to ask though, and this definitely got our listeners a little bit fired up. Like Sean and I were talking about how it's just difficult for us as Indigenous people to walk through the front doors of any church. Silver Spire is different, and Karen Orlandi and members of Silver Spire are doing things differently, but it's still a church. Yeah. So how far can you get with Christians?
And there are other events. I will also be at the St. Catharines Public Library in October, the Beamsville Library actually on this coming Thursday, and at the Niagara Falls Public Library on October 3rd, I think. You can look on their websites for those exact dates. So, yeah, so anybody who doesn't feel comfortable coming into a church, I get that 100%. There's these three library events that they can come to as well. How far I can get? I don't know. I honestly don't know, because I think there's a certain amount of protecting the institution, and that's what happens, right? I mean, churches, businesses, governments, they're all very interested in protecting the institution. And I don't know how far the church is capable of going without having to actually dismantle itself. Because there are some aspects of the institution that are just plain harmful. And that's really, so I don't know. I go back and forth between thinking that it's possible. Like even our very initial conversation that kind of prompted the direction that the book took when we were, you know, waiting backstage about whether or not these two worldviews could ever be reconciled. And at that time, I was hopeful that they could be. But I go back and forth. I don't know.
Well, let's visit that thought a little bit, because this is where I'm in your book, and this is sort of where the book starts. And I think you've actually shared this introduction with publication, so we're not giving any spoilers here. But I remember the conversation. You and I were asked to help open a hot ticket event in St. Catharines at the Performing Arts Center. We met at Mate before, had a little bit of a pre-conversation, and then we went up and I did a traditional opening. You did hand drumming, but we sparked a bit of a conversation. I didn't know you were Christian until that moment, and I have to admit, I was like, wait, you're Christian, but you're going to do traditional Indigenous things? How do those things work together?
Yeah. You know what? I had a moment in church a number of years ago, like lots of years ago, when I was starting to kind of find my way back to community, which I like saying much better than talking about Indigenous identity, because it's not an identity, it's a community. So finding my way back to community, and I had a distinct moment where I remembered thinking I was going to have to choose, that I wouldn't be able to do both. And obviously I chose the Indigenous community. And wherever there is a conflict for me between the two, I will always choose my Indigenous community, and that's I think the only way I've been able to reconcile it, is whenever I do come across a conflict, I will always choose my Indigenous community.
I really want to encourage listeners to check out this book, because these are complex ideas, and the way that I framed the question to you at the time, I think was a bit of an oversimplification by sort of forcing you into that, like the way I phrased it even now on the air, like I hear myself like, either or, you are a Christian or you're Native, now pick right now, Patty. And
you and I know that out in community, and this is what Sean and I were talking about both on the air and off the air with you, like you're at our social tables, like you're sitting there, you're on the board of directors of the Fort Erie Native Friendship Center. You're helping to provide support for community events. You organized bringing Desmond Cole to Niagara Falls to talk about how Black Lives Matter. You believe that Palestine should be free. So to try to cast you into this, you know, you're not Native enough because you're Christian isn't fair. But the church has some work to do.
Yeah, it does. And so that's where I think this question of who claims you is really important. Because the church does claim me. So what is my responsibility there? Even if, you know, even if I don't go anymore, or even if I've divested myself of a lot of, you know, what some people might think of as core beliefs, what does my responsibility remain to the church in terms of helping them do better or rethink their own text? A lot of the ways that they read their own text isn't inevitable. There's other ways of understanding those stories. So because I understand the lingo, so to speak, you know, I understand what their assumptions are, I am positioned to be able to talk to them. But there also comes a point where even Jesus told his disciples, the dust you feed us, the, you know, shake the dust of that town off and continue on. There comes a point where it's like, okay, I'm finished here now. I've exhausted my responsibilities.
Well, I'm sorry that we're finished with this interview. I think we've exhausted a lot of wonderful conversation, but there's so much more. So Niagarans, come to the event at Silver Spire Church. That is at 7 p.m. on September 27th. Which is also the day the book launches. So Windsor, London, go to your favorite bookseller and grab yourself a copy of Becoming Kin with author Patty Kroc. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. Thanks.
I am here with Brandy Morin, who wrote it's already on the top 10 bestsellers list in Canada. Brandy Morin wrote Our Voice of Fire. Of course, she is a respected journalist and a great contributor to the canon of Indigenous peoples leading in Canada. Thank you so much for joining One Dish, One Mic this morning, Brandy.
Tanze, Carl. It's such an honor to be here and connecting with you again. Hi, hi.
I'm glad to have you here. I'm hardly the only person that's talked to you. You're on a bit of a whirlwind media tour, as you should be. The book's great, and I promise we'll get to that in a second. But how many people do you figure you've talked to in the past, like, week or so?
Oh, my gosh. So it started in Toronto just a couple of weeks ago, where I did 2 days of straight press. I went into covering the papal tour across the country and came home and went into the official book launch week. And I think by Monday, I will have talked to over 30 different media, from TV, radio, and print, which is like incredible. It's just, it's wild.
On the one hand, I imagine that must be a lot. On the other hand, I think it's because the book is so good. This really, we were talking a little bit before we went on the air, and I sat down, Brandy, I was going to read two, maybe three chapters. And I sat there for hours and hours and hours. Like, I was fixing my tea and I didn't even want to take my eyes off the book while I was like pouring hot water into the kettle, because it's like, I got to know what's going to happen next. This is a really good book.
Oh, I'm so thankful. It's blowing my mind. I prayed for this book to reach people and to connect with people, but the way people are responding, like, it's taking off like fire, and I'm so thankful, but I'm mind blown.
as it should. I want to ask, when did you decide you were going to write a book?
So my former news director, when I worked at APTN National News, Karen Pugliese, you know, we became very close over the years. She became a mentor. We're very close to this day. She's no longer at APTN News. She's now the editor of the National Observer, just a powerhouse of a woman. So she knew that I am a survivor of the missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls crisis. She knew a lot of things that I had overcome to become a journalist. And so she would say to me here and there, you need to write a book, you should write a book. But I would like laugh her off, like I didn't take her seriously, right? But a couple of years ago, I wrote a article for The Guardian, and, you know, sharing a bit of my story of survival, because I was so sick of the inaction and the apathy that this country has towards this genocide that's happening against our women. And there was a young First Nations girl that was missing in Eastern Canada at the time, and there was not much being done about it. And that article received like international attention, and I just thought at that time, like, maybe it's time to step up and use my platform as a journalist, because I have power as a journalist, and I feel a responsibility to use my experience, my story, for those who did not survive and not live to tell theirs.
I think you've recognized the power of storytelling in your entire career. There's a point in your book where you say having books around you was like being surrounded by your favorite candy, except it wasn't bad for you. can you talk about the power of storytelling to help our peoples?
Oh my gosh, yes. I don't have any formal training as a journalist. I didn't attend schooling for it. I just always loved to read, and I loved writing, and I loved people. And so that's how I built my career, was learning as I went, learning on the ground. But I think that we are storytellers inherently, you know, and have been for time immemorial as Indigenous peoples. And so I think it's something that each of us has a natural ability to do. And, you know, I was just really driven to tell the stories of others and just bring those stories, you know, to the forefront, to connect with people, you know, heart to heart, right? And create those human connections. And that's what I've done. I didn't have a plan to go about it. I just loved what I was doing, and I just did it. And now I'm telling stories in many mediums, not just print, but I've through TV, through, I'm doing podcast documentary. I'm now making two feature film documentaries. So it's incredible blessing, and I'm very grateful.
You do seem to have a wide range of storytelling gifts, and I may have seen on your socials that you were in a video making class a little bit earlier today.
Oh my gosh. I know, with the Shine Network, it's Indigenous Lens, and it's a 4-day accelerator program for Indigenous people getting into filmmaking from all different levels of experience. And they brought in some incredible teachers, such as Sterling Harjo, and it's put on by Jennifer Padinsky. So I'm soaking that all up right now amongst this book launch week, and getting caught up on my storytelling my storytelling with deadlines.
I can't imagine. And you are, I mean, it is worth mentioning that you're talking to a lot of people about the book. You're also coming off a whirlwind tour of covering the papal visit. Are you okay? Like, are you able to keep up with all of these demands on your time?
Oh, you know, I don't, like, the papal tour was intense, and I didn't decide to go on the full tour across the country to Quebec and Iqaluit as well until the week before. And I should have known that it would have been like absolutely insane, because I went to Rome, but we were running on 3 hours of sleep a night, if that. Like, our hours, our day would start at 3 a.m. and we go till 10 midnight. And then not to mention the emotions of it all, because we are all impacted by it, you know, as Indigenous people. And so trying to shut your mind off and all that and take all that in, it was hard. And I'm exhausted right now, but at the same time, I'm just trying to take all of this in while this is happening. This is my first book. This is my first experience. And next week, next Wednesday, I'm taking off with all of my kids, plus my son's girlfriend, to the far north in Inuvik and Tuktoyaktuk. We're going to spend time with family out on the land, and that will be my recharging, my chance to just heal and laugh and be with family. So I'm looking at that to get through the next few days.
I'm glad that you're taking that opportunity, and I'm glad you're finding a way. I struggle sometimes covering Indigenous peoples as an Indigenous person, and so I've really looked up to you as somebody that you're not afraid to tell the truth, that like, yes, mm-hmm. I'm affected by this story, but I can still do a good job as a yeah. journalist covering the story. And you talk about that a bit in the book.
Yeah. And you know, I think like some, you know, I've even been told by various established journalists and stuff, like, you can't do this work because you're Native. You know, and I've really struggled with that sometimes, but I look at them and I say, well, why are you doing that work? You're white, you know, you know? And so I believe that our media, you know, is in a transformation process. I believe in decolonization of the media. You know, I don't really think it does any meaningful service for journalists to be robotic in this work. And, you know, I am connected, I am moved by these stories, but I still give the facts, you know, I still give the facts of the stories. So I think that that is most important. And I think that my work just resonates with people because they sense that authenticity. They sense that passion and that heart that I strive to bring through, you know, from the people who are gracious enough to share their stories with us.
I'm going to ask Brandy about a very personal story that she helped tell in the next segment. Hang tight. We'll be right back after this short break. You start out with a story where you're talking about a very difficult story to share, talking to the family of Tina Fontaine. But actually, I was listening to Auntie's Up, my favorite podcast. It's mm-hmm. not that's not One Dish, One Mic. And Connie Walker said that we need to be storytellers, not story takers. So what are some things you do when you're telling the stories of our people, and maybe if you could take us on a little bit of a deeper dive of what led to your first contribution to the New York Times.
Yeah. So, you know, I just had this urge to have our stories brought outside of the boundaries of Canada. Again, I was, you know, seeing apathy and inaction and just, racism and injustices. And so I thought if our stories maybe begin to reach the world, that maybe that pressure, outcry, you know, from outside would, you know, create transformation here, you know, for justice, for awareness, for reconciliation. And so I was freelancing. I was, you know, pretty new to freelancing at the time, although I had done it before, but I had left a cushy job at CBC Indigenous. And I just cold emailed, you know, Dan Bilewski at the New York Times and introduced myself and said, you know, I'm an Indigenous journalist. I'm passionate about telling Indigenous stories. If you need, you know, if you're looking for any stories, you know, I'm the one you're looking for, basically. So he responded to that. And I, you know, I worked with him just before the final report of the National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls was released in June of 2019. So I think it was that spring that him and I traveled to Winnipeg. And I had arranged for us to visit Thelma Favell, which is Tina Fontaine's great aunt who helped raise her. For those who are unfamiliar with Tina Fontaine, she was 15 years old, a member of the Saguin First Nation, and her body was found dumped in the bottom of Winnipeg's Red River in August of 2014. It was her face that looked like a child splattered across headlines that finally shook this nation up enough to, you know, start the National Inquiry. So we went there and, you know, initially I was supposed to be this fixer and I was kind of peed off about that. I didn't want to be a fixer. I'm a journalist. I wanted to be hands-on and involved, but I knew how important this story was, these issues to get to the world. So I took Dan and a photographer there and just kind of guided in the process, right? Because there's, you know, sometimes these journalists that will come in, parachute in to our communities or into communities that are experiencing crisis or trauma, and take and leave. And I try to create a connection and go in with compassion and also, you know, understanding different cultural protocols. So that was a really intense meeting that hit home for me personally, and people will read about that in the book. But basically, I seen myself all over the walls of Thelma's home where Tina's picture was. And I related so much to Tina. I could have been dead as well. So anyways, that story went on. I was able to get her contributor line and work a couple more stories with the New York Times. But, you know, it's absolutely important for people to understand that they can't go about storytelling in Indian country the way that, you know, non-Indigenous journalists, the way that they traditionally have done. It's harmful, and there are stories there waiting to be told, waiting to be shared, stories of beauty, stories of truth. But it has to be done respectfully, has to be done with time, effort, and education.
I think you do that masterfully there. For people that haven't read the book yet, first off, you can't call yourself a true One Dish, One Mic fan if you haven't read this book. So go out and buy Our Voice of Fire right now. But it everything from your Pilsner-loving Catholic cook'em to the story of Ryan, the piano player, the way that Sox chose you as a writer, so much insider journalism. There's so much good stuff. Like you name drop Kenneth Jackson, Jorge Barrera, Karen Pugliese she is just a gift to Turtle Island and to the newsrooms. There have you heard from anybody that's in the book about the book?
Well, you know, Dan emailed me like a couple of weeks ago because he read an excerpt on Chatelaine, and he just said, very well written and congrats. He emailed me from Ukraine. He's been there covering the war. And Karen, I mean, of course, she's absolutely incredibly supportive. I haven't heard from Kenneth or Jorge. I don't even know if they know they're in the book yet. but, you know, I'm just so grateful to have been really mentored by all these incredible, you know, journalists who saw gifts in me. I wanted it so bad, Carl. And I think that comes across, you know, in the book, that I fought for this work. I ran after it, and I cherish it. I'm grateful for it.
It truly comes across. You say very near the beginning of the book that all you needed was a foot in the door in order to kick it down. And I think you do that in this book. Before I let you go, we have a tradition on One Dish, One Mic where we let our guests have a sort of a traveling thoughts. It's akin to the Anishinaabe traveling song, where we try to send listeners off in a good way. Do you mind sharing some thoughts with the listeners of One Dish, One Mic? Any final thoughts, anything you want to say to the listeners of One Dish, One Mic, just to put a nice cap on this wonderful story that you've shared with us about your great book?
Yeah, so I just would love everybody to know, for Indian country, to know that we are a voice of fire, that we are a generation of fire. And I'm just so happy that we are finally moving into this time of thriving and healing and reclamation. And the world is waiting for our stories. The world is waiting for you to unleash your fire to help change the world. So hi.
Wow, that's powerful. Thank you so much, Brandy.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for having me, Taniki.
The last time I spoke to you, I went the next week to Landback Lane, and then I was arrested shortly afterwards. So I'm hoping that nothing like that happens this time around.
It's an adventure with me. You never know.
it's still dangerous out there for Indigenous journalists.
Oh my gosh, it is. You know, but it's worth it, man. It's worth it. We just got to keep going, keep warring up, and the world is hungry. They're hungry for this, you know, for our stories, for our truth.
Thank you again for joining us.
Hi, hi.
That was Brandy Morin, author of Our Voice and Fire, already a top 10 bestseller in Canada. Do yourself a favor, get ahead of the trend, get out right now, get your hands on a copy of this book. You won't regret it. I read it in one sitting. I didn't just make that lineup for the show. It's that good.
Do yourself a favor and pick up a copy of Our Voice of Fire by Brandy Morin while you're in the bookstore. Have them order in a copy of Becoming Kin by Patty Kroc. You won't regret it. Thanks for checking out One Dish, One Mic this weekend. We will be back live next Saturday from 10 to noon. Ngitwa Swagweg.